It's the True Faith Podcast. Alex Hurst here, and you're going to listen to me chatting to Guardian football journalist and author Daniel Taylor about his brand new book on King Kevin Keegan, My Life in Football. We hope you like the show. This show is sponsored by our patrons who pay £5 a month for loads of extra shows. You don't have to sponsor us for £5 a month. We'll always keep this podcast free. But in doing so, you get all the extra podcasts on Newcastle United. And even if you don't want to listen to extra podcasts, all the money we spend goes back into the podcast in improving the quality of the show, the calibre of the guests, and all sorts. So I'm going to leave you now with my chat with Daniel. Links in the description of this podcast of where you can buy the book and a couple of good deals, I think, are fine. So have a look there. Daniel was an absolutely brilliant, engaging guest, and I'm sure you'll take that from this chat. And you know, we're on at TF Weekly Pod on social media if you want to leave any feedback or discuss anything. I'll stop talking now and leave you with Daniel.
I mean, this is Kevin's life story, really. So this is a part of his life story. I mean, we tell it in at length. I think there's probably the book's about 125,000 words, and this section of this sort of unhappy second spell as manager at Newcastle, I think it accounts for about 18,000 words of those, but that still leaves over 100,000 words on the other part of his life. And you know, the irony being that in the middle of the book there's four chapters on the sort of, you know, much happier times at Newcastle, that I suppose that's probably my one slight frustration. Obviously everyone's so, don't get me wrong, I completely understand why, but everyone's so fixated on what went wrong, the, you know, the kind of this culture of, you know, backstabbing and undermining that he had to endure, and in a second spell there, I completely understand why everyone is very very interested in that. But you know, there's also much happier times in Newcastle. You know, we've tried to tell that story at length, and also just his life story. I mean, his life story is incredible. You know, the guy's won two Ballon d'Ors, and I almost had to kind of shake that bit out of him, because he never, you know, despite his achievements, very, very kind of modest guy in terms of those realms. You know, he's got an OBE, and you know, he won't use that after his name, and he's the only English footballer in history who's ever won the European Football of the Year twice. So I think that tells you what he was like as a player, as well as a manager and a personality.
So how has this come about? Was it, you know, was it always a passion of yours to get this good, or did he approach you? Like, why do you think now is the time that Kevin wanted to tell this story?
Well, I think I'd never met Kevin until this project came up, basically, and it's as simple as that. You know, he came to my literary agent, and basically I've been speaking to my sort of agent. You know, I've written a few books before, but I've never written an autobiography, and so my agent was aware that I wanted to do one, and then we just heard from Kevin and Kevin's sort of a couple of people around Kevin that he was keen to do one, really. And I just think, he brought a book out in the 90s, so obviously he's got, you know, 20 more years to go at. I don't detect any desire on his part to return to football, and I think he was so sort of saddened by what happened last time that it kind of, you know, sort of made him feel that, you know, the sport that he'd sort of grown up, you know, loving, and he still does love it, you know, he still watches the games and everything like that. I mean, he doesn't obsess about it like perhaps I do. Yeah. But you know, whenever I see him, we always end up talking about whatever match was on TV the night before or something. But I certainly think the experiences in Newcastle second time round as manager maybe sort of told him that football had changed, and did he really want to be in the industry as it was if some of the things that happened to him. And one thing I should say, really, I mean, people obviously have seen what's been serialised, but that really is only scratching the surface to the full story. Obviously the Times have got their own space constraints, and you know, they can't produce two chapters in full. But as I say, I mean, there's something like 18,000 words in the book on that era, and obviously the Times, you know, probably condensed it into about a tenth of that size. So there's still sort of another 90% of that story to be told in the book. So that's a slight frustration, but obviously, you know, don't get me wrong, I think the Times has done a really nice job with it, and you know, we're pleased that the story's starting to come out, really.
And obviously, because of the serialisation and the fact that, you know, I mean, Kevin Keegan isn't just, everyone listening to this, I presume, or most people listening are Newcastle fans, but he's also massively popular in other parts of the country as well. So I presume you've had to try and find a balance of not just talking about the bad times at Newcastle or the good times at Newcastle, but like you say, a rich and varied career. That, you know, I presume this is going to get this interest in Germany.
Book is the full life story, really. And I mean, not just popular in England. You know, I mean, he regularly sells out on sort of talking events in Scandinavia, and these massive, you know. I mean, a guy from my work the other day said to me, you know, you wouldn't believe, you know, a guy from my work who lived in Germany said he wouldn't believe how many people there are in Germany walking around with the name Kevin, you know, in their 40s. And, you know, because basically, you know, when he went over there with Hamburg, he was a huge star. And, you know, I mean, part of it's been quite educational for me, you know, in terms of sort of learning a lot more about Newcastle, to be honest, is one of the things I've enjoyed. But also Liverpool, you know, Bill Shankly, and all those years that Kevin spent there, you know, he won pretty much everything at Liverpool. And I suppose the difference between him and the other Liverpool players was Kevin decided to leave. You know, not many people would actually, you know, if someone left Liverpool in those days, it was normally the club's decision. But Kevin, you know, being the guy he is, he wanted to go and experience what it was like abroad. And not only that, but he made a fantastic success of it. You know, he's named German Man of the Year. So, you know, the guy's life story is incredible. I mean, I've joked with him in the last few weeks that really we could have probably done with two books. And I mean, Bobby Charlton told his autobiography in the space of two books. I really think that Kevin could have done the same. Really, you know, there were quite a lot of episodes that we both of us would have liked to have told in even more detail.
Yeah, and I mean, I presume Kevin was great to work with. When you were working with him and writing the book, was it hard for you to try and get aside or around the modesty of the man to try and get him to talk up the achievements? Because, like you say, twice European Footballer of the Year, I mean, glittering success at Liverpool silverware wise, and then Newcastle, which we'll come on to, can't be measured in trophies. I mean, personally, I don't think trophies are that important in terms of what he achieved at Newcastle. But was he kind of forthcoming with all of these things? Was it a little bit difficult to get out the immense achievements?
He's a great storyteller, and I mean, he'll tell stories, but what I mean is there is a degree of modesty with it as well. It's probably, you know, I'm the journalist, I'm sort of trained to ask the question, so I think if we hadn't mentioned the fact that, yeah, you know, at some point you were also given an OBE, I think he probably would never have mentioned it. You know, it's me probing with those questions that brings the answers. But I mean, we all know Kevin is a, you know, fantastic storyteller, you know, great anecdotes, always opinion on everything football wise so for me, you know, I got into football journalism to basically, you know, to, well, A, because I wasn't good enough to play football, I suppose, but B, you know, I wanted to be a smallish part of the football world. And so to actually, I mean, when I was first offered it, my first thought was, well, what a great offer, but that could be logistically a bit of a nightmare, because I live in Manchester, and I thought, I just presume Kevin was still North East based, but he actually lives about 10 minutes drive from me, so that made things, you know, so much easier. Basically, I could just pop down to his house in a short drive. So, and you know, just sort of, we started. I mean, we first of all went to a couple of restaurants in the village where he lives, and we did it that way. But in the end, it sort of morphed more that I would just drive around to his house, and we'd sit in his front room and put the tape on, and then Jean, his wife, and, you know, lovely lady, amazing family, very, very strong and close-knit family. Jean would sort of just bring in an endless supply of, you know, pieces of toast and cups of tea, and while we sort of sat there, and someone said to me at the start of the process, you know, once you speak to somebody for more than 2 hours, you know, you get tired, they get tired. You know, there was a bit of a peak time where, you know, you kind of realise it's probably time to call it a day, but there were times with Kevin where we were sort of sitting there for 3.5-4 hours, and then you get the feeling that he would have sat there even longer and chatted. So for me, you know, it was quite educational, and, you know, just to sit with someone that's experienced what he has, and to listen to the man, and basically learn from the man, I suppose, as well. And you know, I'm just glad that you know, I could help him put it together in a book form.
And I presume you're not just coming to Newcastle at the Sage, which is a sold out event. You're around the country. Has there been much demand to hear Kevin talk?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a non-stop stream of requests from journalist mates as well, sort of just trying to get see if Kevin could do any interviews. And it's been a bit of an eye-opener in terms of the world he lives in, you know, just how constantly in demand he is. And you can't quite understand it unless you're actually in that world, really. And I've only had a small taste of it, but I've had so many requests, and ideally, you don't want to disappoint anybody, but equally, the man has to live. You know, he's doing a two-week book tour. The Newcastle one's a bit different because obviously that's going to include the big event at the Sage, which is say the sellout, which is great. But you know, he's doing Southampton, London, Manchester, Liverpool. It's quite tiring. You know, sort of. You know, we'll get back from that event in Newcastle, I imagine, in the early hours. And then the following lunchtime he's got to be in Liverpool to do another event. And you know, don't get me wrong, I know he enjoys it, but it can also be quite sapping, those sort of. So it's quite a grueling couple of weeks he's got ahead. He's doing interviews. I think he's appearing on, you know, I think it's the BBC sort of, the breakfast TV shows. And he's been pulled around left, right, centre for a few weeks, but obviously that's just, you know, part of the book writing process.
I mean, let's move things on to Newcastle then. Positives first. People who listen to this podcast know where me and the lads who do it come from and how old we are. We were Keegan's playing days at Newcastle were a bit before, well, definitely before our time. But we did like an audio documentary just interviewing people about what Kevin Keegan meant to them and the story and the stories that were got back about how influential he was as a player at Newcastle, not just a manager, and how he kind of almost came to this meandering second division club that wasn't going anywhere. The stadium was falling apart and transformed the club within 2 years of arriving, with Terry McDermott as well playing alongside him, into a Division One established club. Have you managed to spend like good time in the boot kind of telling that story? Because if you speak to people of maybe over 40 and over in Newcastle, you know, his playing days are not to be underestimated, and how like one player transformed a football club. It's not really something that I can think of a modern day equivalent, but one player going to a football club transforms it as much as he did Newcastle United in the early 80s.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's talked about it at length, really, and you know, when he dropping down the division, it probably cost him his England career as well, because he was never chosen again, basically. And I think, sadly, and the sort of strange thing is, bearing in mind how much the two men have got in common, you know, there was always he and Bobby Robson, you know, two great Newcastle legends, basically. You know, they had, you know, really big difference of opinion because of that, and Kevin obviously talks about that extensively as well, you know. But when he first went to Newcastle, obviously, I think it raised a lot of eyebrows, put it that way, because obviously he was dropping down a division. But I think when you speak to Kevin when you get to know him properly, you know, he's born in Doncaster, he grew up in South Yorkshire, but he will tell you that he always felt a strange part of Newcastle. I kind of know what he means slightly, because my dad's Scottish, and I was born in England, but all my relatives were Scottish, and you know, he had the same thing with Newcastle. You know, he remembers that when his dad was around other Geordies, like how his dad's accent would suddenly pick up, and you know, so he was always fascinated, I think, by Newcastle United, and by, you know, all these sort of stories he kept hearing about the football fans and everything. So I just think that he felt it was a natural thing that at some time that he would end up there, basically. So I think at the time it was, you know, a very questioned move, you know, why is England captain dropping down a division? But he always made decisions for himself. You know, people questioned why he was going back to Southampton from Hamburg. You know, people couldn't understand why he would want to go to a club of Southampton size when, you know, there was talk that Liverpool would take him back. But Kevin, being his own man, he went to Southampton because he thought that he could win the league with Southampton. It would be better for him to win the league with a smaller club than it would be for a bigger club, you know, like, I suppose, a little bit like Leicester have done in the last few years. You know, the Liverpools and Man United are used to win the league almost, whereas someone like Leicester or in those days at Southampton would never have done it before. So, So yes, I mean, yeah, he loved it at Newcastle. He says that, you know, he'd never experienced, you know, he'd obviously had a form of hero worship, I suppose, at his other clubs, but it was different at Newcastle. He said the noise was different, you know, at Anfield. You'd get it all from the cop. He said, at Newcastle, he came out with a great line about it's like being in a sort of stereo sort of surround system, because it basically just came up from everywhere, you know, around it. So, you know, I mean, first goal he scored, he jumped in the Gallagher, didn't he? So, you know, I think he quickly sort of embraced the Geordie courtship, probably because he always felt that he was a bit of an honorary Geordie. You know, he wasn't born in Newcastle, but he always got it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean. And he comes back as a manager when the club were in dire straits. I mean, there's been all sorts of speculation since about what would have happened if we hadn't stayed up that season. That when he kept us up, but that period, I presume you cover with him between retirement at Newcastle and then coming back as manager. You know, it always seems strange for me looking back, and I presume you're the same. You know, that he wasn't kind of, you know what, you know, Frank Lampard's just gone straight into a managerial position, and it seems very much to be an easy step these days. But you know, he spent a few years out of the game, didn't he? And does he go into the reasons why?
Well, he was living in Marbella, and he was literally doing. He was living in an amazing place, in, you know, just enjoying the sunshine, playing golf most days, sort of having a swim, you know, going for a jog in the morning, and basically just sort of unwinding from the grind of professional football, you know, because to be in that position where you're always the kind of number one, you know, you're the superstar, for want of a better word, you know, I think it is quite mentally tiring. You know, it's always you they need at the press conference, it's always you that the TV want to interview, it's, you know, it's always every game, it's always you that the people want to be, you know, you have to justify your reputation. So I think that probably is quite mentally sapping after all that time, even for someone, you know, who's got exceptional energy as Kevin has. But yeah, I mean, I find it's almost unheard of now. You know, he had 7 years out of football, and in that time he pretty much turned off from football. I think he would know the big results, and he would know who won the league and who was going for the league and who might be about to be relegated. But he wouldn't know, you know, who was on a great run of form or who, you know, or every result from the sort of, you know, all four divisions, etc. When he came back to Newcastle, you know, he actually admits that basically he'd heard of like two or three players, but a lot of the players just were names to him, you know, just had no idea who they were, whether they were any good. And then it was a case of, well, normally you'd sort of ask your staff, but he's like, well, I didn't know who my staff were either. So he was parachuted in completely. You know, he had his football knowledge, and obviously he had that incredible sort of energy and drive and ability to sort of get, you know, I think when you're Kevin Keegan, players would want to impress you, you know, so I can see why. I can see what, you know, he had things going for him, but also it's still extremely unorthodox, I would say, for someone, you know, to be put in that position when they're literally sort of looking down the squad list, thinking, well, I don't know who he is, you know, for the vast majority of the players. And then obviously you look at the results, you know, the way things picked up. I mean, obviously, you know, it came incredibly near to that relegation. And as Kevin tells it, he was told by the people above him that Newcastle would fold if they went in the third division.
Yeah.
I think he believes that with the size of the fan base, I think he always hoped that wouldn't be the case. But it was, you know, that was Sir John Hall, who knew about business and knew about, you know, what companies need, and that was what he told. That is what he said to Kevin Keegan. So you can imagine the pressure that was on in that. You know, when he took over from Ozzy Ardiles to keep them up, and obviously, you know, he had a honeymoon period, and then I think they, off the top of my head, I think they then lost five games in a row and went back into the relegation places. So, you know, it was touch and go right up to the last game of the season, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, and then obviously, you know, when he came back for the start of the next season, he's writing his programme notes straight away that, you know, they want to get promoted and win the Premier League. So, you know, that's Kevin's attitude, basically. You can imagine people reading that thinking, what is he talking about? But you know, he very nearly did it.
And the same the next season as well with promotion. There's a famous bit of footage. I think it's Football Focus when he says, you know, Man United, we're coming for you type thing.
Well, he wrote it in his. I've seen, you know, I looked through the old programme notes and they're, you know, talking about this place will take off better than Liverpool. You know, I just think, well, Liverpool. You know, I was brought up with Liverpool winning everything, and, you know, we just, it was like a reluctant acceptance. You know, I'm a Nottingham Forest fan that Liverpool will probably end up still winning everything, and, you know, so he was kind of focusing early on Liverpool, but then obviously what he hadn't accounted for was that Man United would then take over from Liverpool. So to be fair, he was kind of true to his word halfway, because he basically said, you know, we will overtake Liverpool, which is, you know, which is what Newcastle did briefly. But obviously, you know, there was still the Alex Ferguson emphasis at Old Trafford, really. So unfortunately, he couldn't properly get the better of him.
I mean, even last night, this is how well Keegan's side, early side, I still thought of last night. Phil Neville on Match of the Day 2 said he thinks Wolves are the best team ever promoted to the Premier League.
And that pissed me off as well, because I've just told you I'm a Nottingham Forest fan. We finished third the year after you finished third.
Right.
So you came up. I think you actually outscored. I mean, I haven't got the league table in front of me. I think you actually outscored Man United that year, who'd won the league and finished third. We then came up the next year, finished third, and possibly could have even finished higher, but Stan Collymore, our striker, you know, who was basically just ripping up the entire league, was injured for a month. And then I saw, you know, don't get me wrong, Wolves have done really well, but they're 10th, they've played 6 games, they've won 2 of them, and basically all of a sudden they're the best team that's ever been promoted in the Premier League here. And I was thinking, well, I mean, I think Ipswich finished 5th 1 year. You know, if Wolves can finish third or 5th, then maybe I'll come back on and apologise. But I just watching that, thinking, you know what, you know, I mean, I did actually look and Phil, because I thought, Phil Neville, when my team actually won at Old Trafford that season.
And
I did actually look last night, because it irritated me so much to see if Phil Neville played, but he didn't do, his brother did, but Phil didn't.
Nice. And I suppose one of the things I think Newcastle fans will be interested, will be looking forward to this book. It's not all negative, because there's the immense success that Kevin had finishing, like you say, third, sixth, second, in that particular second. Do you manage to go into much detail? Not, obviously, a lot of people know what happened. I'm sure there's some extra insight, but how he kind of reflects on that now, because I mean, I think it was 20 years. 2 years ago, 2016, and there was a lot of local media in the northeast about it's 20 years since we blew that title. How has Kevin kind of react on that 22, or feel about 22 years on?
Well, I'm sure it will always be the biggest regret of his professional sort of life, but the way he is, I don't think he's also the type of person that sort of sits in the dark room, you know, sort of shaking with kind of the bitter memory, you know, of blowing the. The, you know, that 12-point lead and everything, you know, and I mean, he does a lot of talks now and does a lot of sort of business company days, and I get the feeling he will always, one of the things that's most likeable about him is that he's quite happy to laugh at himself, so, you know, I think he includes a few jokes about the, you know, the Love It rant and, you know, a couple of sort of little pokes at Alex Ferguson and things like that, so, you know, I think he's very happy, basically, and he's got, as I said earlier, you know, he's got a lovely family around him. Jean's wonderful, and, you know, I mean, when he looks back on his career, that's obviously a major regret, but I don't feel like he should look back on his career with a regret when you look at what his achievements and what I was saying earlier about, you know, the fact you can actually need 2 books to write his autobiography. So, but yeah, I mean, they were a great day. I mean, funny enough, when he mentioned about them finishing 6th, you know, he would regard that season as a total failure, basically, having finished third the year before. You know, but I mean, he set incredibly high standards there, and, you know, we cover the whole sort of, you know, obviously the championship chasing season, you know, what went wrong and what, you know, and why he kind of, how can I put it, sort of lost his rag on TV, and, you know, all the Andy Cole stuff, and, you know, just you know, his recollections of that era, really. You know, it's all covered in, you know, there's I think there's 4 chapters on that era, because I think, despite the fact that he, you know, managed England, He managed Manchester City for 4 years, which is longer than anyone since Tony Book in the 1970s. And obviously, you know, he won all, everything that he won at Liverpool. I think it's pretty obvious that Kevin is known for first and foremost because of that sort of legendary period as manager when, you know, you obviously came within a whisker of winning the league. And obviously when you think, as I say, when I talked about earlier being a bit educational for me, you know, I kind of forgotten where you come from. You know, I know you know you were promoted, but just to have, you know, to have picked you up when you were basically sort of, you know, down in danger of dropping into the third division, and just hearing some of the stories about what he inherited, and, you know, basically, you know, nobody wanted to, the players that he identified as deadwood and needed to move out, nobody wanted to buy them, and the state of the training ground. Just, you know, he came in when the club was on its arse, basically, and, you know, look at where he then took, you know, just an incredible journey, basically. And you know, even as a non-Newcastle fan, I think everyone can remember that era really well.
Definitely, and that, you know, that the championship season, even the season of finished sixth, it's still really fondly remembered, with the crazy European games and trips, first ones for decades for Newcastle United, and everything that you see now, I'm sure that you'll be aware, and hopefully he's aware that, like, you know, the massive football stadium in the heart of the city, one, you know, where European Cup rugby being there next year, that's all because of Kevin Keegan. That's, you know, they're almost monuments to him.
I wasn't using the times, but basically when he went back in, I nearly call it fancy dress. It wasn't really fancy dress, but it was more disguise. You know, he kind of put a flat cap on, and because he was invited to a leaving do, and his first reaction was, you know, I can't go to St James's Park. I'm not welcome. You know, I didn't know what to expect, etc., etc. And sadly, he didn't really want to be there because obviously, you know, it's Mike Ashley's name above the door, and that's what he associates it with for now. But anyway, so he was persuaded to go to his event, and he tells this sort of story about him. You know, he turned up in, you know, smuggled himself in, basically, you know, with his collar turned up, and, you know, sort of talks about, like, you know, kind of walking in the shadows and, you know, parking his car sort of in a little back street and sort of just making his way around in a, you know, very surreptitiously to get in without being noticed. Even though basically as soon as he'd been in there, you know, a member of staff noticed him straight away. But anyway, he tells a story about going up to, you know, to where this event was taking place in one of the suites, and he sort of found himself, and he's not really one to sort of go back places anyway, Kevin, but he found himself looking out of the sort of window of this, you know, I imagine it's some sort of like executive suite, onto the pitch, and basically, you know, like football grounds at night time when they're empty, they're quite kind of emotive places. I think he kind of got lost in his own thoughts and was just sort of reminiscing about, you know, he said he was sort of thinking about all sorts of funny things, like, you know, does the pitch still have a slope? He said, you know, when you're in the dugout, you can see a slope that I'd never noticed from having nobody in the dugout. But and one of the other guests came over to him, and basically, I think he realised that, you know, Kevin was having a bit of a moment, sort of, you know, looking out on this pitch and the stadium. And the guest said to him, you know, that this place is because of you, basically. And Kevin was just, you know, kind of, you know, quite humbled at what this guy had said, basically. You know, just a little comment said that, you know, this would never have been here without you, like it is now. And, you know, like it is now is a fantastic stadium, even though I keep being told that it's looking a bit grimy around the edges at the moment. But essentially, you know, it's a great stadium. And you know, and the floodlights were on, you know, so the pitch was lit up, and this little comment that one of the fans, you know, made to him sort of really stuck with him. So it's quite a nice sort of nice story the way he tells it in the book.
Yeah, I can't wait to read that. And that's spot on. It transformed a city. Kevin Keegan transformed a city in a region. You know, post-industrial place having a tough time in the late 80s, early 90s, and he, you know, for me and for most people listening, he's the most important man in Newcastle United's post-war history, and possibly the city of Newcastle, even away from football, in terms of what he's,
well,
what he's
saw,
created.
George Corkin, who is a really good mate of mine, and not only that, I think everyone probably would say, you know, just an incredible writer, and
definitely
the first person that people probably turn to about Newcastle news and comment. I saw him this morning and writing, you know, I mean, Kevin Keegan should have a statue outside at James Park. Now, Kevin would never dream of saying that, and, you know, but, you know, George can obviously say it because he's, you know, he's got his freedom to write what he wants, but I just, you know, I just thought, well, yeah, you know, basically, you know, bearing in mind the man's status in the city and, you know, it, but obviously, what you've actually got, and we were talking about statues, I mean, what you've actually got is an owner and a regime that basically, where he, you know, describes himself as unofficially banned and doesn't, you know, just has to wear disguise to get in because he talks about not genuinely knowing whether there'll be a hand on his shoulder saying, you know, clear off.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really make it up, really, what some of the stuff that, you know, some of the stuff that's going on. And, I mean, George also made the point, I suppose with the Astley stuff, it's not just a historical document because it's still going on. You know, what the very unorthodox way of running a football club is still happening now. So you know, the two things are actually directly linked, aren't they?
Definitely. And there's, you know, Kevin Keegan, fans have always said Kevin Keegan just gets Newcastle, the football club, the city, the people. And like you've correctly said, that's probably because of his family heritage. And
his grandfather was, you know, a hero in the... I'm sure you know all the history. Yeah. His grandfather was a hero in the Stanley mining disaster. You know, sort of was pulling people out. And, you know, and there's a poem written about him at the time. So, I mean, you know, his family go back a long time. They came down from the northeast. I think his dad was looking for work, basically. You know, so there was one of the collieries in South Yorkshire had more openings, basically. You know, which was quite a common thing. I think it's quite, you know, where I'm from in Nottinghamshire, there's a lot of the miners who came down were from the northeast. So, you know, so yeah, you know, he definitely has very strong links to the northeast, and he does just get it. You know, I don't think he's had to try and learn. I think he just gets it. You know, which is quite a rare and you know, nice thing, basically.
Definitely. And there's a clip on YouTube which I'm sure you've seen, and my memory escapes about whose testimonial it was, but he came back in the mid 80s and basically give a very honest former player interview in the tunnel about the state of the ground, the club, players being sold, fan unrest, boardroom. And it's quite scary that 30 plus years later, you know, I watched that video and it basically describes the current malaise at the club. So Kevin Keegan, throughout his life almost, has got what's going on at Newcastle. But one of the things I'm really keen to read in the book, Daniel, is I know obviously the serialisation is about the intensely negative stuff, which is raising a lot of questions about you know, the ethical practices at Newcastle United. But when Keegan came back as manager, I think that there is not enough credit given for what he did in a football sense, because that team was horrific under Sam Allardyce. Now, I've heard people on various talk shows, football news stations who Newcastle fans don't tend to listen to, saying that Sam Allardyce, you know, that Sam Allardyce was sacked and Newcastle were relegated, which isn't true. It's a common misconception. He got that team playing some tremendous football by the end of the season. It was a tough turnaround. I mean, there's a 4-1 win at Spurs, Redden were hammered at St James's Park. There was some really notable, in a very short space of time, he turned Sam Allardyce's disastrous Newcastle side, which in my opinion was headed for relegation, into something of a football team, which was playing really good football. And the start of the next season, we'll go to European champions Manchester United, newly crowned European champions Manchester United, and with a better team and get a 1-1 draw. Does Kevin, do you have a chance in the book to maybe even try and redress that? Because you always hear Kevin Keegan Newcastle is a great example of don't go back. Well, it's actually don't go back. It's got nothing to do with what he achieved in a football sense. It's all this other stuff you talk about. And I think he kind of gets a hard time for it. He went back, he'd been out of football for 8 years or whatever it was, and to me it just wasn't true. Are you able to kind of go into that with him in the book, or is it very much concentrated on what went wrong in that?
No, we'll go into that as well. I mean, when I talk about Kevin gets it, I mean, he wouldn't be critical of Sam Allardyce, but he also made it clear, just in a politer way of saying it, I suppose, that he understood why the Newcastle fans wouldn't embrace that type of football. And going back, he knew that they would embrace his type of football. You know, basically, you know, Newcastle fans didn't wait until Saturday every week for you know, a dour 0-0 draw, or someone trying to get like a 1-0 win with, you know, with the tactics that Sam Allardyce was using, and that was fine with him, because, you know, I mean, there's a bit of a misconception with Kevin that every game was 4-3, you know, which isn't true at all. And he get, you know, I think he always says that, you know, the number of times people come up to him and say, "Oh, I remember that 4-3," and Kevin has said, "Well, actually, Kenny Dalglish was manager then." And so I think he only had two 4-3s in his life at Newcastle. And the other thing about his teams couldn't defend was just another absolute myth. You know, if you look at the when in the year that United came back from. Sorry, Manchester United, I should say, came back from 12 points behind. I think Newcastle finished with 2 goals worse off. You know, it's until the last week of the season, they both conceded the same number of goals. So there's a slight misconception, but ultimately, his team were known as the entertainers. They were a flamboyant side with, you know, he would always go for attacking play. I remember when he came to Manchester City and he was playing Sean Wright Phillips as a right back. And one of the coaches said to him, how do you expect a teenage kid, you know, as any young lad then, a teenage, the smallest player on the pitch to be heading away back post headers at corners? And Kevin thought, well, I see it more that he would be a brilliant overlapping attacking right back, you know. So, you know, all the, you know, his fullbacks at Newcastle were always deliberately attacking minded players. So he knew that, you know, going back, he wanted to. Basically, he was at a much, much, much better starting point than he was when he first. So he thought it was going to be better than the first time round, and they didn't do too badly the first time round. So, by better, what he's talking about is he was thinking, you know, if I get the team playing like we did a few years ago with the start, because even though they weren't playing good football under Sam, when you go through the squad, they actually had, you know, he had some good players. Yeah. You know, there was the makings of a half decent team there, and they, you know, he weren't in the bottom three. I think he was something like 13th or 14th. 14th, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't a proper crisis, and the team wasn't, you know, you weren't devoid of decent players, basically. So, you know, so he went back basically thinking that I'm going to win the league here, or I'm going to go for winning the league. I don't think he'd be that presumptuous, but that was certainly his intention. You know, aim as high as possible. It's not come out yet, but, you know, the players he wanted were elite players, basically, and he was made to believe in his first talks with Mike Ashley and, you know, Tony Jimenez and Dennis Wise, and that basically they were, you know, they shared his ambition and his vision of what Newcastle could become. You know, don't get me wrong, Mike Ashley said to him, you know, he's not a Roman Abramovich, but equally, you know, to, well, the way it turned out, he didn't, you know, to say, I don't think he explained it was going to be like that either. But anyway, but yeah, Kevin had great, exciting plans. The players he wanted were players who, in his words, would have taken the roof off St James's Park. And if people ever say that's a bit unrealistic, how could you target, you know, world elite names? He would say, well, if I ever had that attitude, Alan Shearer would never have come back to Newcastle. Sorry, he would never have come to Newcastle. So, you know, he was thinking positively, as Kevin always did. You know, this is the guy who, when you were just survived relegation to the old third division, was writing in his programme the start of the next season that he wanted to win the league and then win the league above that as well. So, you know, some people might scoff at that and, you know, find it all a bit, you know, a bit overly ambitious, but, you know, Kevin has shown in the past that he can, you know, he's not all talk, he can deliver.
Definitely. I'm not going to keep you much longer, Daniel. It's had you ages, but finally, just, you know, on this stuff, the serialisation which has come out, and you've said that barely scratches the surface of what's in the book. You know, obviously you have to be careful about what you write, because, you know, the people that run Newcastle United have banned people before. They've taken on journalists before.
It's fine. I've been banned by Alex Ferguson before as well.
Right.
It's all fine. I've actually been banned by Nottingham Forest as well, which is my own team. So, but that's unfortunately just a consequence of the job, really. So it's all fine, you know. Sorry. Go ahead. Were you going to ask a question?
I was just going to say, obviously, everything printed is true. Why do you think Kevin's kind of, has Kevin deliberately waited to tell this story, or is it something that he he didn't want to tell, but like obviously the revelations today that have been in the Times about the South American as players being signed for South American agents as favours, you know, I'm not sure on Premier League rulings or player rulings and stuff like that. Do you think that the stuff that is going to be released when the book is out next week, do you think that there will be serious questions asked of the people running Newcastle United more so than that already is?
Yes, because when I said about scratching the surface, I can understand entirely why the Times went, you know, the Times today have serialised about the section involving, you know, the two players who were brought in as a favour for a couple of South American agents, and I can understand that. But equally, I'd say that most Newcastle fans would know about that, so it's the fuller version, and it's... you know, it's a more in-depth version. It's Kevin's thoughts on the subject, but I don't think it's, you know, I think most Newcastle fans knew that, you know, that was the crux of one of the big issues that came out from his tribunal. But there's so much around the edges that hasn't been used, that, you know, just so many damning kind of little pieces of detail that, when you see, I mean, backstabbing is one word for it. You know, he's been lied to. People have apologised to him and then done exactly the same again. You've got people in very high positions there who will you know, be exposed for telling stories that aren't true. It's probably the politest way I can put it. You know, there's an awful lot of... anecdotal stories about other players that, I mean, basically the big fallout was about transfer policy and Jimenez and Wise ganging up together and doing things behind Kevin's back, and basically Kevin almost being a passenger really while they completely ignored and marginalised him. But but there's also so many other details that just sort of really, really embarrassing detail. I mean, one of the things that has come out that I can mention now is just the thing about Tony Jimenez. You know, this guy who was a steward at Chelsea, you know, then went into the property world, whatever that means, I'm not exactly sure, and then, you know, somehow got in with Mike Ashley. And there's a bit of history of this, where Mike Ashley seems to appoint mates or mates of mates or cronies, you could say, and, you know, but he basically gave Tony Jimenez this incredibly important position of Vice President Player Recruitment was the official title, and, you know, one of the jobs was to bring in a centre half, and, you know, during transfer discussions it turns out that Tony Jimenez, you know, self-proclaimed football expert who by the sounds of it was very, very sure of himself and liked everybody about all his contacts around the world and how he would make Newcastle a serious player. You know, he had never heard of Per Mertesacker. Yeah. He'd made his Germany debut 4 years earlier. He'd played in a World Cup. He'd played in every game that took Germany to the final of Euro 2008. And I'd imagine at that time, even though maybe you think now, well, he wasn't so clever when he was at Arsenal in his last few years, but at that time was probably, bearing in mind his age as well, so he'd been quite young, probably be one of the most sought-after centre-halves in Europe. And this guy had never met, you know, even as a sort of, you know, in terms of football knowledge, you just think, well, you know, give me strength, you know. So, but that I can assure you that is far from the only story where you think, can this be real, you know? And Kevin actually says, you know, some of the stuff at Newcastle, you cannot make it up, because it's a level of kind of, and I'm sure you don't want people to use this word to describe your club, but it's a tragicomedy, you know, it's like a farce that's been going on there. You know, Kevin said, sometimes I have to try to laugh at it, because, you know, I mean, at other times it's sort of, you know, we obviously feel incredibly down and depressed about it, but even within 2 weeks of being there, you know, when you talk about his turnaround at Newcastle, within 2 weeks of being there, there had been enough for him to... I'm amazed he lasted as long as he did, because within 2 weeks of being there, he'd been massively let down over all sorts of stuff, and he'd realised very, very quickly that some of these guys don't have a clue what they're talking about. You know, it was like proper amateurism, And unfortunately, Jimenez and Dennis Wise at that time, I think that's not the case anymore, but at that time were thick as thieves, basically. And then they brought in Jeff Fatia, who, you know, again was their man. And then Derek Lambais, and basically they were ganging up on, you know, it was Kevin's, I mean, the tribunal ruled in favour of Kevin, but it was Kevin against quite a few people. So that probably also tells you about that regime. So ultimately, you know, the books should stop really with the owner, but I genuinely don't know how much interest and how much attention he's paying to it.
That's a fitting note to finish on. So thanks for your time, Daniel. I'm sure everybody listening to this will buy the book. It's out 4th of October. And best of luck with your events going on, and then we appreciate your time.
Good stuff. Okay, nice to speak to you.